Okay, let's go ahead and get started. My name is Dr. Aaron Patton from Purdue University, and I'll be moderating our session today as well as serving on the panel. Our discussion this morning is going to be on this topic up on the board here, tips to preparing an application, and that's going to include a discussion on the CV or the resume, a discussion on your cover letter, and a discussion on for academia, things such as research, teaching, extension statements, or philosophies. So we're going to try to cover each of those topics today. We do have an hour and a half scheduled, so we'll have plenty of time to address any questions that you might have for the moderators. I passed out some post-it notes for you. I've collected most of those, and I'll walk through the audience here in a few more minutes and collect any other questions that you'd like to ask to the speakers. I think we'll probably cover most of the questions you have, but I'll work through these notes that you've these questions you have written here and make sure that we have we can address those questions in our session today. So let me start off just by introducing our panelists today and kind of get us started. So I've asked each of the I'll get into that in just a second. So let me read some short bios for each of our panelists up here, and I'll start with Jamie here. Jamie Bruninger has been employed for Dow AgroSciences for 21 years and is currently technical leader in field research for turf and ornamentals. For the past 14 years, he has had the role as a people leader at Dow AgroSciences and has been involved in the hiring of some 20 or so positions over that time. He's directly responsible for hiring scientists and technicians whose backgrounds vary from those of being new graduates to those that are more experienced professionals. So he brings a lot to our panel from his direct experience on industry. Our next panelist is Dr. Beth Gertal from Auburn University. She's professor of turfgrass science there. She has a BS and MS degrees from The Ohio State University and her PhD from Oklahoma State University. And she has worked at Auburn in turfgrass management for the last 18 years. And she is past chair of the C5 division of CSSA and a fellow of ASA and CSSA. And so Beth has a wealth of knowledge on interviewing from her own personal experience and also interviewing others. And so that's why I've asked Beth to serve on our panel. And our last panel member on your far right is Dr. Joe Anderson. Dr. Anderson is my boss, so that's a good reason to have him on the panel. Dr. Anderson became the head of the Department of Agronomy at Purdue University in 2010. Before that, he was member of the USDA ARS program as a research scientist for 18 years in crop production and pest control research unit, located at Purdue as an adjunct faculty member in our department. His research was on the topic of developing innovative strategies to generate virus-resistant wheat and oat lines, and he was a postdoctoral fellow at Cornell University and Washington State University, and his master's and PhD come from Iowa State University. And then my position is as assistant professor of turfgrass extension at Purdue University in the Department of Agronomy. And so I put myself, I guess, on this panel just because I've had a lot of recent experience with interviewing for positions. And as an early career member, as a member of the early career member committee, I thought it would be good to have some a voice from an early career member as well on this panel. So while I walk through the hall, through the alleyway here, collect any last questions you might have. If you want to spend 1 or 2 minutes just telling us a little bit more about yourselves and what kind of role maybe you've had in hiring, and then we'll get started with our first question on what are some tips on writing a CV and resume. So let me start with you, Jamie. Just tell us a little bit about your role as kind of a hiring person there at Dow AgroSciences.
Yes, I've been involved in hiring people directly for open positions at Dow AgroSciences, and I've served on a number of panels as we've brought candidates in to interview. And, it is an interview with a company like ours is very different than an academic interview. So those of you that are interested in how a industry interview might be conducted, there is a website that you should probably go to at the Weed Science Society of America. They have a really nice website there, and under students, there is a section written that specifically references interviews at companies, and there's different company representatives, so I would recommend that anybody that's going to go on an interview take a look at that, and to the Weed Science Society of America website under students. But I've been involved in a number of panels and selections of candidates, and the interview process at a company like ours is called behavioral interviewing. And if you're going to go interview with a company, you need to be prepared, because it's very different than applying for an academic job.
Well, while I've been at Auburn University, I've been on many search committees, all the way from hiring our new provost to hiring technical support staff. Also on the other end, in the role of being a graduate student advisor and undergraduate advisor for that matter, I've helped students, I regularly review resumes, prepare them for interviews, and really try to sort of provide a very personal touch all the way to, should I get my hair cut? And the answer usually is yes, to what to put on your resume.
So I've been all the way from hiring undergraduates to working my lab, looking at their resumes, helping them prepare resumes to go to graduate school and to other jobs, and all through hiring faculty. In fact, we have one starting in January, so I've gone through that process as well. And I've done this both in terms of USDA scientists as well as faculty at Purdue.
Okay, so Dr. Anderson, I'll get it right back to you, and could you just briefly discuss some tips for preparing a CV, and maybe what you would look for as a department head when you're interviewing someone on their CV?
I guess the as you look through and prepare a CV, you want it to be crisp and clean so that it you have some bullet points. You clearly need to have some definition or statements about some of the things that you've done, particularly your research or teaching, whatever that experience is that you're applying to go to that position. But they can't be too long. And you really need, I think, at the end of the day, to have someone look these over, several people look them over, and to really critically evaluate them. Don't pick your best friend. Pick someone that you think is going to look at it critically. Don't be bashful about asking for that advice, and take it to heart. They may tell you things that you may not want to hear in terms of how that's put down, but they're trying to really help you out.
Beth, could you kind of just give your perspective on that as well, and maybe also describe, one of our questions from the audience is just describe the difference between a resume and a CV, maybe what your thoughts are on that. Both of you can.
Well, I guess we just had an orientation for freshmen, mostly freshmen, but some sophomores, and part of this was getting them prepared for a job fair that we just had about a week and a half ago. And the resume, I think, is a much shorter document than a CV. A CV, to me, denotes somebody that has been through a number of jobs or has done research and teaching or extension, whatever it may be, and it's just a more full-blown document where you show speaking invitations, you show publications, etc. And typically the resume, I think, would be for someone that just simply doesn't have that much experience, yeah. Would be my guess.
I would jump in and say that, you know, from an industry perspective, a CV that is 30 pages long or 20 pages long, it is way too long for us. The hiring manager will get 100 applications for a job now, because people apply online. And you'll be looking at a stack of candidates that's this high. And the challenge is to get through it and get the information fairly quickly to select something that's 4 or 5 pages. It's simple to go through, get the information, well written. Grammar is extremely important. What Joe was saying, that have somebody else look at it. It needs to be well constructed and simple that we can get to the information. It's a lot of work for the hiring person to understand where this person is and kind of digest all that. It just takes too much time. So that's what I would say. So we're more interested in resumes and CV.
From a CV standpoint for a position at a university, I just came off rotation on our university promotion and tenure committee, which at this point in your career you probably don't care about, but it did afford me the opportunity. I've seen over 210 CVs in the last 3 years. And as you work on your CV, resist the urge, be very, very clear, particularly in regard to your refereed journal articles and symposia and to what things are. If you don't think it's refereed, don't put it down as a refereed article. Also, avoid the temptation to put everything down that is in preparation. The rule of thumb I usually use is, at your stage in your career, if it's being submitted, do you think they could put it on? Now, for tenure promotion decisions, we only want it if it has a letter of acceptance. But if you've submitted it to a journal, I think you could put that on to show the selection committee that you are working on your MS and PhD out. But if it's in prep, I tend to avoid, now there may be disagreements, I see a lot of professionals in the audience as well, but for me it kind of says, I'm not sure about where they are with that particular manuscript.
What order should things be on their CV, and do you customize that for the job, or do you list that in order of strengths? How should you order things as far as your research, teaching, and extension accomplishments, or even your service on your CV? Anybody that wants to jump in?
I'll jump in. The first thing we want to see is the stated career goals in just a couple of sentences. The educational background. We like to see the thesis topic and the major professor for that thesis topic if you're a recent graduate. We also like to look at grade point average. That's important to us. It shows a level of commitment. We usually see people, undergraduate grades, they mean a little bit, but the graduate level grades mean a lot to us. And it's interesting, when I do look at grade point average, and then we actually ask for their records from the universities, and I always go to the classes I struggle with to kind of evaluate. So I go straight to the organic chemistry and the physics. So if you do so well, that's fine, because I didn't do so well either. Your work experience is important, and we like to see concrete examples. If you just list, if you've had jobs and you list just the role, it doesn't help us that much. You need to kind of describe what you've done, and that helps the person look at that. If you have gaps, it's okay that you have gaps, but people kind of wonder what you've been doing. If you've taken time off to go to Europe, that's fine. We'd like to do that too. It sounds great, but if you have a big gap, that's something you want to explain. And from a company perspective, sales experience is good. Working with customers is good. That may not be as important at a university level, but when you are in a career that's, a commercial career, a dedicated R&D organization supporting a commercial organization, that's very good. And we've hired people that sold stocks, sold cars. That is very valuable to us, that you've been able to work with people, and so that's something to add. Awards and publications are important. And what Beth was saying, separate out peer-reviewed versus other types of publications. So you should have your peer-reviewed versus non-peer-reviewed. And presentation, something in the last 5 years is important to us. You don't want from the history of when time began. So, last 5 years you could.
I would agree with all of those points. I think, and the one I think I would like to emphasize is if you, when you put down a job that you've had or something that you've had is, you know, what was your role in that and how did you actually take that and achieve the goals that that you were expected to achieve in those positions? Many times we're asking people to essentially, what are your leadership skills? I mean, some of this is personnel or you know, how you work with individuals. But the majority of you, because of where you're at in your education and all of that, eventually you would like to become leaders within whatever organization you want to be at. And we would be assessing that as well.
And keep in mind, you may have supervisory experience that you're not aware of. So those of you that are perhaps a PhD student and you had a couple undergraduates that helped you with your project, somebody had to supervise them. It was likely you. So make sure that you may have some supervisory things there that you hadn't heard, and you need to put those sort of things in the document to show you can run your own program.
I think a couple other tips, just a lot of the questions we've had are real basic, you know, kind of like how do I get started on a CV, and the way that I did it, and I think a lot of faculty have done it over the years, is just to find a CV for someone in your field that you respect. Of course, hopefully one of those is your major advisor, but go online, find most of the time today these CVs are posted online. If not, just email whoever the person is and just say, hey, I'm trying to put my CV together and I, you know, respect you from hearing you at some of the scientific meetings and want to know if you'd send me a copy of yours that I could evaluate. So find examples, two or three examples, and just kind of look at how they have theirs laid out and just structure yours in a similar format. The nice thing about looking at other CVs too is you might find a category, you say, well, I've done some of that, but I've forgotten to put that on my CV, and it's a good way for you to see some of that, or maybe see an interesting way that they have presented their CV. And then another thing that's been really helpful for me over the years is I just constantly keep my CV up to date. And part of that is because as a faculty member, we have to submit an annual review document. I'm sure the same thing in the industry of what have you accomplished over the year. And it's really easy for me just to go to that CV if I keep it up to date and transfer that information over to my annual review document. So every time you give a presentation at a scientific meeting or if you get a paper published, just pop that right in your CV and keep it up. It's much easier to keep it up to date all the time than it is to try to catch up and remember all those things that have happened over the last couple of years and to try to update it that way. So that'd be one thing I'd recommend. And one other thing that I've found over the years, and this goes to the point that some of the other panelists have brought up about brevity, is when you first start putting together a CV, you'll want to include everything. But there's a certain point where, you know, you don't need to list out everything. For example, if you've given, you know, a certain point of your career, if you've been an author on 40 ASA abstracts, well, you don't need to list all 40 of those ASA abstracts. So you might just have a two-sentence line that says, has published 30 ASA abstracts, and you don't need to list every single one of those. And so look for areas, as your CV grows over the years, look for areas that become large and bulky and say, are those really important? Is that the important story I'm trying to tell with this document? And if it's not, then you can summarize, you can still leave some of that information there, but condense it and summarize it so that you really are highlighting the most important areas. Okay, any more comments about CVs before we move on? Another question, Beth says. Okay.
I guess just the only other point is when you have to write some of these bullet statements or whatever, one of the other things that we always look for is impact. What was, so you did this work, and at the end of the day, what was the impact in terms of that position? And I think if you can highlight that and put that in there, that would be very useful.
Okay, the next topic is on preparing a cover letter for a job application. So I've got a few different questions. How long should the cover letter be is one question, and the other one is you know, what do you put on it, I guess. So I'll throw that out to our, Jamie, we'll start with you.
Okay. The cover letter should have a strong
expression of interest and enthusiasm for the job you're applying for. You shouldn't be applying for a job, you should be applying to a job. And, you know, if you've done your homework, you know a little bit about the company you're applying to, there are press releases, there are scientific presentations. If you've done your homework, you kind of know where the company is going in the future. And, you know, we hire around projects. We'll have a project like the Enlist project. That is a huge project in Dow AgroSciences. And each company has their projects that they're working on. They hire around that. That's when they bring on new people. So right now we're on a growth strategy. We're hiring because of these traits projects. And if you know a little bit about that, you can say, I can see myself going in this direction with your company, and I think it has a strong impact on the future of agriculture in the United States or in the global economy. You know, so a strong interest in what's going on. You want to state, you know, why you're applying, and then you want to make sure that you have the correct company in the cover letter. We've gotten cover letters saying they were applying for a job in Syngenta. So it made for a chuckle in the office. It was good information, but you know, you don't want to do that. And the cover letters should have, you know, good grammar, good English. If you send an email to a company representative, you know, you should look at that and make sure grammar's important, spelling's correct. We've gotten letters from potential candidates that all they want is, tell me a little bit about the job and how much it pays. So, and we just got that in the last 2 weeks. I talked to a hiring manager, and that's what she got, and she said, huh, hit the delete button. No interest. If you're going to send an email to a company or to someone, send them a resume, CV, resume, some information about yourself. I'd like to kind of tell you, you know, you have a hiring manager who's typically in a company, a middle manager, and he has bosses or she has bosses, and their boss and their boss's boss is going to interview this person. So it's a reflection on the middle manager, you know, who's brought in. And you want them to do well because, you know, it's company resources, it's people resources. You know, you're spending a whole day interviewing this candidate. We have, you know, a lot of time devoted to that. And, you know, so it reflects on the hiring person. And they have a limited amount of time to go through these things, right? You know, you'll have a stack of 100. So, how do you decide who to bring in? Well, one of our strongest recommendations is from our own employees. So if you know somebody that works in the company, that helps a lot. Because there's a stack of 100 here. And if I have, you know, I know someone's applying for a job with our company, I'll call that hiring manager if the person has worked and, you know, I know them well enough. And I'll make a few phone calls, and I can get that resume pulled out and I'll look at it because I've made that recommendation. It's okay to drop names in the cover letter. You know, you can be a name dropper. That helps because our strongest recommendation is going to be. Right. And one of the things that you want to make sure is if you're going to use that person's name in the cover letter, that you've talked to that person ahead of time. And they're going to give you a good recommendation. So that helps. Networking means everything. And, you know, from the beginning of your program as a graduate student, you should be talking to a professor saying you're interested in working here. You know, you should be thinking forward. Now, things can change, but, you know, you should try to meet company representatives. You should try to meet faculty from other universities. You know, you got to work on it from the beginning because today's hiring environment is so many people are going to apply for these jobs, and they come from all over the world. I mean, we get applications from everywhere. So it's hard to go through that. And so if you know somebody in the company, that really helps.
You clearly need to target your cover letter to that particular position. And I would not use templates for this exact reason that you will It's an inevitable that you'll make a mistake. So, you know, start off fresh with that letter. You can certainly cut and paste and so on. But you want to certainly express your interest to that specific position that you are applying for, and, you know, show. You don't want to repeat what's in your resume so much, but you do want to indicate how your expertise will fit in with that position, and that you are very excited about it. You know, I went through to an interview, and I didn't show the level of excitement that I really had for it, and I didn't get the job. So you need to really, you know, say that you are excited about this position, and that should come out in that cover letter.
Right.
Length, one page, would be my guess.
Mm-hmm.
Would you?
I agree. And don't have your cover letter stretch on for 3 pages or more. Also, don't make it an 8 or 9 point font, because a lot of us who will read it are very old people. So we like really big fonts. So, you know, 12 point, or sometimes I'll make my cover letter for something even a little bit bigger, because I think it makes the letter look quite elegant. And I don't have half inch margins either. So just proper pagination, make it look good.
This is your first introduction to the person that's reading that resume. It has to look great, has to have excellent grammar, et cetera, because this is the first time that you're going to be selling yourself, the first view.
Yeah, I think I agree with everything that the panelists have said. One thing that's, you know, from my personal experience from the link standpoint is that might have been about a page and a half long in the past. And one of the things, if you look at the way these, especially these academic positions get posted, they're getting longer and longer and longer. They may take up a whole page on just what the position is, or even more. And so it's tough to, and you want to address the qualifications that they're asking about in the job description and the position description. And so, you know, I think what everybody said there is appropriate. One page would be great, but if you can't do it all on one page, don't be afraid about the, you know, using a page and a half or up to 2 pages. But you don't want to make this long and lengthy. You want to convey your interest in the position in a quick way, and then be done with it, because the people reading these packets don't want to read all day long. They want to, you know, get to the point. My advisor always said, be bright, be brief, and be gone. So you kind of follow that philosophy. I interviewed a person once who was interested in coming into my program, and so I was interviewing her for potentially to come on as a master's student. And I asked her, I said, you know, what can you tell me about my program and you know, our program here at this university? And she said, nothing. And so she didn't get the job. Okay, and so related to what Jamie said, you know, you want to make sure that your cover letter details that you're familiar with this position and what this department or what this company, what kind of products they offer, and as I think Joe said, how you can fit into that company, that department, what you're going to have to add to that, and so that's really important.
Are you guys taking questions?
Yes, we'll take questions at any point.
Okay.
Yes.
Say it's you're applying for a job in the company, and you'd like to tailor your resume, your CV to that position, but all you've got is the online position that's really kind of vague. Any suggestions for getting more information about that position before you send your cover letter?
If you know somebody in the company, that really helps, and you can tell them that you're interested in applying for this job, and what can they tell you about the particular position? For instance, right now, we have an opening in pest management in our group. And any of our people that are involved in urban pest that's working with termites. So anybody that's working in the termite area for our company would know about the job and be able to tell you more. And if you don't know somebody in the company, you know, somebody in your department, your professor or someone like that might know somebody. You know, we hire from certain departments, you know, routinely. We go back, we have a lot of Virginia Tech graduates in our termite business. For some reason, we hired a lot of people out of that department. In the entomology area, we've hired a lot of students from LSU. You know, so you might have people that are working in those companies that from your university, or you know, it's not a huge industry, so you know, we know each other. The other thing about working, networking with companies is, or people from other companies, is if we don't have a job, we might know of a job of who's hiring. It might not be one of the premier, you know, multinationals. It might be a job that, you know, you might fit in well. You know, you don't always start at the top. And I'll tell you my experience is when I finished graduate school, I interviewed with Dow, I interviewed with DuPont, I interviewed with Monsanto. Guess what? I didn't get a job with any of them. I wasn't ready. I had to go out and get some experience. And I was a much more attractive candidate after getting that experience. So just because you're rejected by a company or an institution the first time doesn't mean that that's forever. You might have to work out there. So that's why I think that.
I think one last thing I want to add on the cover letters is make sure that your, and I think this has already been addressed, but I just want to emphasize this, make sure that your cover letter addresses the right priorities. And what I mean by that is, if you're applying for a job, let's say at a university that is primarily teaching, then your cover letter shouldn't start off telling you how great your research program is, and then at the very end of your cover letter, you have one sentence that says, oh yeah, I also TA'd this class while I was in grad school. And your cover letter should start off, you know, with the same focus that the job description or the position description has. And so if the position description says, this position is a teaching, primarily a teaching position with also a research appointment, then your cover, then I would address your cover letter that way. And I would also consider aligning your CV in that fashion as well, so that it looks like your experience and your interest level aligns with the job that's being advertised.
So I'll talk a little bit about an ARS job. They typically, when they advertise for these, they have something in them called KSAs, or Knowledge, Skills, and Abilities section. And they will list out a number of the particular items that they are would like to see, experience or knowledge or whatever, in those particular areas. And those are things that you really need to address either in your cover letter or somewhere within your application. ARS now will accept a resume or a CV, where before they had this very long application form that you needed to fill out. And so that's been good and bad. The good part is you don't have to fill out this laborious form, but the bad part is you still need to go and find with those knowledge, skills, and abilities section is within the job advertisement and address those. And those really go to any of the job advertisements that you see. They all have, in some facet, those knowledge, skills, and abilities section that you really need to address.
Okay, let's move on to our next topic of research, teaching, extension. Oh yeah, you have a question?
Yeah. So, I just want to follow up with what you said, Dr. Joe. So, I've read some ads for like postdoctoral positions, and my thinking when I was a postdoc is, you know, you want to improve the skills you've got, but you want an opportunity to acquire them. And so instances you have situations where, you know, there is no skills they expect you to have, and say you don't have all of them, but you know, you think it's a good job because then you'll be able to acquire the others. Sometimes you're torn between, am I expected to already know all these things, and supposing IT, why would I want to work here, because I'm looking for a place where I can acquire most things. Would you recommend that, you know, once you still go ahead and submit an application, would it be wrong to submit things you do not necessarily have all the skills of people?
I don't think it's a bad thing that you don't have all the skills that they need. But I think what you need to address is that how interested you are and what your capability is of learning those skills. And I think that would actually go a long way. It's because it tells the person looking at the resume or the CV application that you've done your homework, yep, and you're more than willing to learn. You are eager to do that because you want to enhance your toolbox. I think good ways to phrase that. You want to build upon the strengths that you have and say, I'm looking forward to move ahead and to improve myself, and I think this job is the way to do that.
Yes. Excuse me. I'm asking about when I'm writing a CV. For example, I'm applying for a PhD in agronomy, for example. And I have some other experiences which are not related to the agronomy, like working in cancer-related research and other experiences. Shall I mention these experiences while it's not related to the job or the position I'm applying for, or not?
So the question is, if you have related experiences that aren't directly relevant to the position, should you include those or not?
That are not other experiences that are not related to the position.
Right.
I would, because they may not be directly related, but they show organizational skills, they show supervising skills, perhaps they included report writing, detailed report writing and presentations, and they may not be the focus of particularly of your letter or your CV, but they're part of you, who you are, and your work experience, and I think you need to be in there. Yes.
There are probably elements that you're going to have to highlight what you did and how that could potentially apply to what your the job or the position you're going for. So you're going to have to help the hiring person or the university faculty person understand how that could relate. Because if they have to figure it out on their own, they may not. So if you point them in the right direction, that will help.
You know, we're in an environment, particularly in the university system, where we're looking at interdisciplinary research and becoming a bigger and bigger focus of what we do. And so experience that you have that is maybe related in some tangential way can actually be a plus. So I wouldn't discount it, and I would, it's part of your whole package that we're looking at, and Jamie is as well, I'm sure, looking at well-rounded individuals that bring a wealth of knowledge and experience, depending on what level you're applying, what level the position is that you're applying.
One other comment that's important to always keep in mind. There, when you see a job announcement, you think you're qualified, or maybe you think, oh, I'm not there yet, but it might be worth your while to go ahead and apply. I sit here, and the job that I was hired for was offered first to three other people. And that was back in the early 90s when times were good, and they each took that job offer back home and translated it into a pay raise. And so the committee said, okay, we're tired of this. We're going to interview the first brand new PhD, and that was me. So you don't know what will happen. I know of several ongoing academic job searches right now that they have closed the first search, they didn't find the candidate they liked, and they've reopened. So, you know, go and talk to people at the hiring tables while you're here, and yeah, maybe that job is 6 months away from where you think you are, but you just don't know in this economy and this landscape what will happen to your position. The one you think I'm not ready for it may still be open in 9 months, which we don't really like, but sometimes that's how it is.
I would say that we don't keep jobs open for 9 months. Yeah, those jobs are open for a period of time, and you better fill them while you can, because that job might be frozen, because we're a business and we operate on a business cycle, and if sales or the global economy affects us, you know, we might freeze the job for a period of time. So we like to fill them. But we do have jobs that we have interviewed candidate after candidate. And I was on a discovery, or a discovery job in our weed science department, our weed science discovery area. And that job was open for a long time because they were looking for the right candidate. It took a while to find them.
Okay, our next topic is what is a research statement? And one of our audience members had a question on that, and so did I. The last job that I applied for that I'm currently in requested that I include a research statement. And I thought, what in the heck is that? And I knew what a teaching philosophy was, and I knew what an extension philosophy was, and the position also asked for those documents, but it asked for a research statement. And that was something, that an area that I'd never been mentored in, wasn't really sure exactly what it was, and so I just kind of had to go to the web and find out. And it aligns pretty closely to what an extension or teaching philosophy is. And so I'll let the panel, maybe Beth and Joe, talk about from an academic standpoint, what are hiring institutions looking for when they ask for these extension philosophies, these teaching philosophies, and for these research statements?
So I think there's a few different things that we look for. One is the ability to articulate a vision or a particular approach that you want to take. Let's take the research as an example. You've either done work as an undergraduate or graduate student, postdoc, and you have actually a wealth of experience that you can put down there. And then the question is, how do you want to translate that experience into a research program that will be at a university? What do you want to do within the context of the job application, or what the job is looking for? What kind of end goals do you think you would like to accomplish? Will we hold you to those once you get into that position? No, because we know that things change. But at least it gives us a roadmap of how you think and where you think the field is going to go within the next 5 years or so. Mm-hmm. You can't really predict past that. But we want to see how you can articulate that. And really, at the end of the day, that's where we start, I would say, at the interview. Those are some places that we can start having a conversation with you about, because you've articulated that. And we can have a discussion and some questions from that. The philosophy part really is based also upon your experiences that you've had as a teacher and as a student. As you have gone through classes, you've seen some pretty poor teachers and you've seen some really excellent teachers. And what will you take from those? And how do you want to be an educator, a top-notch educator? And so those things are really based upon your experiences. And that's really what we want to see come out of those letters or those philosophies, is where, how do you take those experiences, internalize them, and then come up with your own approach to things. You can certainly look at philosophies and statements that are on the web and from your colleagues and mentors. But I would look at those probably and put them aside and start writing your own. They're great examples. They can certainly give you some structure. They can even, you certainly can't cut and paste, it's not good. But you can use those as an example. But you really need to start writing your own. And frankly, when I applied for the department head job, it was probably the most challenging few pages that I wrote.
I think the thing to keep in mind, too, is that these documents, these philosophies, these research statements, they're living documents. They're going to be changing as you change and as you experience different things throughout your career. So if you write a teaching philosophy today and you look at it a year from now, you might say, well, I don't agree with that anymore. I think there's a different approach that I would use now in the classroom. Or same thing with an extension philosophy. And obviously your research statement is going to change as your research program, as you develop your program, you gain new experiences, you move into new areas, you fine-tune or maybe get more focused on what you want to do research on. And so as you're applying for jobs, you definitely need to be these documents need to be updated every time. It's not something that you can just link or attach to every time you put a new application in, because these are really going to be changing dramatically over the course of time. Is there a question in the back? Yes?
Is the research statement something you want to personalize for a job, given some of our fraud research interests?
Yeah, I would definitely personalize all of these for a particular position. And so, for example, on the research statement, one of the things that I would include is, you know, how does my program fit in with the place that I'm applying for? Who are some of the scientists in that particular department that I would like to work with, and how do I think I could integrate my program with what they maybe already have going? And so I think that's extremely important because it shows lots of things, shows that you've done research on the position, you know who the players are in that particular department, you know what their topics of expertise, and you've given thought to how you might be able to collaborate with those faculty members or those scientists to improve, deepen, widen your research program. So definitely I would customize a portion of that document to that specific position.
I would say at the university, we're not hiring an individual faculty member that's going to, be a sub-level to themselves. That's just not how we operate. We don't want people to operate like that. We want to be collaborative scientists that are use the expertise and knowledge that is that their colleagues have, so that they can build teams or programs that are cross-disciplinary. So if you don't customize it, I think you're selling yourself short.
The teamwork thing is very important, and a philosophy of working in a team. If you've done that type of research statement, and thought about it ahead of time, it's very valuable during an interview. And it's something that, the thought process, we really don't require a research statement, but if you've gone through that process and you brought that out in the interview, that would be very valuable. A common question, if you're an expert, for instance, in herbicide weed management and corn, say, well, where do you see the future with glyphosate resistant crops, and what is the impact of, what's the future going to look like, and what's your vision of that? What's the future of agriculture in that particular area that you're an expert in? If you've gone through that thought process, it's very valuable, and crafting your research statement will help you.
Yes, question.
I have two related questions. First, approximate length, and then appropriate amount, level of detail for these statements. I could go on for pages and pages about the research that I've done, because obviously I know the details, but what are you looking for in terms of the level of detail, both in what we've done, but also in what we kind of anticipate doing? Because, you're looking, that's not a proposal, but...
Yeah. The term that is often used when you write some proposals to some agencies, I'm trying to think of the exact term, is sort of, that could be understood by a person with a little bit of scientific background, but probably not highly technical. It's more, where do you think, James, where do you think things are going? What's the general area in which you work? As far as length, I'd like to keep it again at around 2 pages. I think folks don't want to read pages and pages of things. When I say 2 pages, really, it doesn't need to be double spaced, but dense single space, spacing and a half. Again, it's a document that you want to be readable and attractive, and that the eye looks to it to read it.
You might feel a little bit in the first paragraph, the kind of experience that you've had. Just briefly kind of touch on a few points and then take that and say, given that, this is where I can see my program going. And so you can take a look at these statements and structure them based on sort of an introduction. It's a typical sort of essay that you're going to write. There's various sections that you can think of. And then at the end of it, you want to talk about, okay, if I do this, what's the impact going to be? You want to have some way to close that that says this is important.
Yeah, I one of the documents that I found online, this one from Penn State, actually, from the engineering department, was they talked about 5 components to a research statement. Of course, everybody's going to have a little bit different idea of what they think that should be. The first was just kind of like an introductory, kind of almost like an abstract to the document. The second thing they said include is just kind of a little bit about your background of your research program, you know, what experience have you had in the past. Then they recommend you kind of summarize what your current research is, and then where do you see yourself going in the future? And that's where we've talked about things such as, you know, what does the future hold, and how's your program going to fit into that in the future? And the last thing would be, as I mentioned earlier, how's your program then going to integrate into the position you're applying for, and what kind of collaborations you see having? So that's kind of what an outline of what the document might look like, and it's going to, as Joe said, make sure to address some of the impact of what your research is. So, and I agree with what Beth said, think about your hiring committee as a diverse group of folks. And so in my case, I'm a turf guy, but I'm going to have a soybean guy on the hiring committee, I'm going to have a nutrient person, I'm going to have someone that's all teaching, someone that's got extension. So you got a diverse set of experiences on the hiring committee, and so you want to make sure that you don't go into this level of specificity that someone in a discipline, related discipline, but not in your discipline, isn't going to understand. So if you start name-dropping genes and proteins and stuff, then they're going to get lost. But, you know, you're going to have to write that a little bit more broad so that a diverse hiring committee can understand exactly what your program is.
Yeah. If say you're applying for, say, an industry position, does it make sense to include something like a research statement if it's not asked for?
I asked specifically that question to one of our people that has done a lot of hiring for our northern U.S. market. And, you know, what we really want to see is your research goals in the top of the resume. A long research statement, we find it interesting, but it's not necessary. Because obviously, you know, we have projects that we're, you know, we've done, committed a lot of resources to those projects. So maybe a statement saying that you're interested in working and applying your experiences towards that project would be important. But a long research statement, I don't know what we would do. We'd look at it, but we wouldn't require it.
Yes?
Can I come back to the idea of collaboration and both interpersonal and leadership skills? I certainly only struggle with that question because I know I'm relatively sociable and get involved in extracurricular activities, but I'm never quite sure how to, you know, to address that. So those people that employ people, would it be specific?
We, in a company like ours, across the whole spectrum, and it doesn't matter what level of employment you are at, we have certain competencies that we look for. And there's a list of that. There's initiative, takes independent action, and seizes opportunity. So you're able to, you know, a lot of people have good ideas, but some people have good ideas and never do anything with them. If you have an idea and then acted on it, that's important to us. That shows you have initiative to follow through. Innovation is something, creativity, you know, how innovative have you been, and examples of that in the past. And there might be examples that you haven't even thought of. I remember when I applied for Dow, the job with Dow, I was going through some questions. I had this book. And I was going through some potential questions, and my wife said, well, you've done all this. What about this? You know, there's things that you don't even think about that you've done. Interpersonal effectiveness, how you're able to develop relationships with other people, how you work with people of all different diversities, that's very important because it's a very diverse environment today, and that's important. Leadership, which Joe was talking about, have you led others, have you led a project, you know, that's important. And the ability to learn, that is another competency. Market focus is something that a lot of new graduates struggle with because they've never worked in the industry. They don't have examples of working with customers. But there might be something related to that. Teamwork, which we talked about. And the last one is value creation. And value creation has to do with creating value from a business perspective. And a lot of new graduates haven't done that. So, but I think if you point out to your initiative, your interpersonal effectiveness, your leadership, those are some really valuable things that we look through as we evaluate, look at a resume or even in the interview process.
It could be that you want to develop, in your case, a particular category on your resume or CV that you can highlight or point to. Again, the resume is, and examples that you'll see are just that. There are examples that you can use parts of, don't use parts of. If you want to, if you have things that you think would be informative to the person looking at it, given your social skills and the groups that you've been a part of that may not be related to the scientific component, I would you can generate that on your own.
We really didn't mention this, and actually Aaron has served in this role with extension, but extension is kind of has this newer umbrella word called outreach. And a lot of you probably have done a lot of outreach and you put that in your CV or in your or mention it. For example, we had a PhD graduate student who he ran my community food bank garden for the better part of a year for me. And actually it was a big reason why he got placed in a faculty position because it showed he had a strong outreach component. So if you've done work in the schools or been a judge for the science fair or help run something as an undergraduate, study your running club, all that stuff really can be documented under outreach. It may not be directly related, but it again shows leadership and initiative and working with people.
You should definitely have Beth kind of captured as outreach or service. Sometimes some of these things fall in their service category. So on your CV, you should definitely have listed service opportunities. And that's going to show a lot of what you're pointing to. Is that hey, I can I'm on these various committees, I'm active in these roles with these different groups, and that's going to show a lot of those skills that you mentioned. Yes.
I've worked on a wide variety of projects, but they've all been sort of in the background, so I don't have authorship on a large number of papers. How is that going to play in, and how could I
how could I play up the projects? And I have participated in my CV and make it understood what I did.
I'll
jump in. You know, if you support a project, if you describe what you did, you don't have to be the lead author or, you know, give examples of what you've done in that particular activity. That will help. And it's okay if you support it. There are a lot of people that make projects successful. It's not everyone that's, you know, leading the charge that does it. You know, there's a lot of people that contribute to these things. And so if you personalize it and say what you've done, that would be a value.
Oftentimes that may link to a specific skill, particularly if you've done a technical role. So there's particular pieces of equipment that require specialized knowledge, GC mass spec or some advanced, that's where you can maybe bring out your role. This is what I did, this is what I set up, I developed this particular piece of equipment and methodology.
Is there any documents from a USDA standpoint or from a industry standpoint that we haven't discussed but that are important in the application process that we want to talk about?
Well, ARS will always ask for your grades, for your transcripts, and it doesn't matter how far back. Okay. The initial application, I don't think has to be original, but I think the final application needs to have original documents sent, which is sometimes a challenge for the international students. So you might want to think about that sort of proactively and realize that you're going to be needing some of that. And I would guess if the industry is asking for those, I don't know if you need the originals or not, but there has to be some level of surety
copies will do fine for us. It always makes for interesting reading, like I said, to go back to some of the mistakes you made as an undergraduate. We interviewed a guy, and he had an F on his transcript. I'm like, what in the world? So the first thing it's asked is, how did you get an F in this class? Well, what the person did is he skipped the first level of the class. It was a second level course, you know, a series, and they just jumped to the second course, and then he went back and took the first series of the course and then went to the second, they got an A. But, you know, just because you had something like that in your past, you know, that's okay. Just, you know, don't be embarrassed, because it happened to all of us. We were students, you know. There's always reasons, and I remember a student that we ended up hiring, and they, as an undergrad, worked through school. You know, they had like a 2.5 average in the grad school, and, you know, straight A's. And said, what happened? Well, it's pretty obvious. You know, some of us have to work through school, and that can take a lot of time and effort. And when you look at that as a hiring person, you're saying, well, then I can understand. So.
Well, you might want to address that in some aspect of your document being sent forward, because I guess my question would be, if I looked at that and you saw such a discrepancy, you know, what's the reason for that? And is that a reason to put that resume aside and not really consider it too much? But if you address that and give some rational, reasonable explanations, then it goes a long way towards saying, okay, we're going to keep that in the good file.
All right, last question, and we'll make sure to open it up to audience questions. Is there anything else anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to mention?
One thing that if you're applying for a job in a particular country and you don't have citizenship, that's always something that needs to be addressed. So visa status is important for us. We can work through those challenges, but it needs to be addressed up front. I don't know how you.
ARS, if it's a permanent position, requires U.S. citizenship, unless they're unable to fill the job with U.S. citizens. And then there are some, it takes quite a while to go through the hoops, but then they can open it up to non-U.S. citizens. But that is a fairly rare exception.
And I would say that if you worked and jumped from job to job to job, that would give a hiring manager pause, so some explanation of why you would have jumped like that. Because it's a lot of effort to bring somebody on board. And we realize that, you know, I've worked for Dow for 21 years. Not everybody joining the newer generation, you know, may not want to stay with the company for that long a period of time. And we realize that, but, you know, there should be some explanation if you jump from job to job. Because, you know, it's a lot of effort to bring somebody on board, get them trained, get them positioned, and then they up and leave 2 years later. That's pretty tough.
The only other thing I wanted to expand upon a little bit was what we talked about with name dropping with cover letters earlier. One thing that worked out well for me, and you have to kind of give this some thought before you move forward with that, is if you have a good advisor or mentor who has a connection with wherever you're applying for the job, is to have that person make a phone call. So in my case, my advisor called someone that was on the search committee of the position and said, hey, you should really consider my PhD student. This is what his strengths are. I think he would be great for that position. And that, I think, was, you know, hopefully one of the contributing factors towards me making sure to get an interview and then ultimately that position. So if you have a good mentor, someone you trust, or you have to definitely have someone, make sure that the mentor that you have is not just an acquaintance, but someone really has your best interest in part and can be a good advocate for you. And if they have that relationship with someone in the company or the university that you're applying for, then I would ask if they might might be willing to do that, or they might even offer to do that for you, and that is definitely a help. Anytime that, that you have that in, you have some of that networking that's going on, that's a real help for getting making sure that you get an interview. So, and then once you get to the interview, my experience has been, it doesn't matter really what you write on your CV or your cover letter, it's all about the interview. And so my personal experience, and this of course varies from person to person, is a lot of people you interview with, they haven't looked at any of your documents. You think, I spent all these hours putting these together, you just assume that they know everything that's on it. But a lot of the times, I mean, these are busy people. They don't have time to look through all these things. And you're going to be interviewing with people that aren't on your hiring committee, but that you meet with during the week. And so it's important to keep that in mind as you interview with folks, because you're going to have to, don't just assume that they know all the great things about you and why that you should be hired. You know, you might have to tell them a little bit about yourself, and just kind of keep that in mind as you interview. Because I know when I interviewed for my first job, I thought, why are these people asking me this question? They should have read my CV. It tells the answer. But most of them just, they're busy people, and they don't have time to dig in depth to that. Now, there's certain people on the hiring committee that will know your document well, but assume that the majority of them will probably have no clue. So, and once, like I said, once you get to the interview, it's all about your interview, and your documents just kind of go out the window. And they'll reference them after you leave, and they're talking about who should we hire, but during the interview process, assume that they don't know what's on your document.
I've been through interviews where it was completely obvious that the person that came in, who looked great on paper, had no idea about the institution that they were interviewing at. They hadn't really looked to see who the other individuals were that they were going to potentially collaborate with. And the other thing that was a surprise to me is how poorly some of the seminars went. So at Purdue now, it doesn't matter what kind of position you're going to come in for. This is faculty positions. At least in agronomy, we'll always have you do a teaching and research seminar because we value the teaching component as much as the research side. And again, it doesn't matter what your split is. So you have to be prepared for that and do practice. Have peers critically evaluate you so that that you're comfortable not only with the subject matter, but also the kinds of questions that you might get asked. This is your chance to shine. And you're going to have a group of people in that interview. I don't want to stress this too much, but you're going to have a number of people in that room that won't have read your CV, et cetera, and this is their time to evaluate you. So think about that and enhance your speaking skills, et cetera, so that you can do a bang up job. I think we're all pretty convinced that you can, and we bring you in because we're convinced that you have the skills and everything to be in that position. But you got to show us.
Yeah, I would say that we also ask particularly new graduates to give a seminar. And we don't, some of the experienced professionals, if we're bringing them in at a higher level, we do not always require them to have a seminar. But I've never seen a candidate who did not have a good seminar not have a really good interview. It kind of sets the stage, because it's usually first thing in the morning, and you'll be on the panel and you'll be interviewing that candidate later on. You learn more about the candidate from the seminar than really from the paperwork that you get. And first impression can mean a lot. So that's our first chance to see you.
Okay, I'm going to open it up for any questions you might have before I give us a couple minutes of concluding comments. Yes, in front.
Yes, I'm asking about the implementation and the CD of the supervisor. For example, if I have some experiences and some lasting things, or some deliverability needs, or other leadership skills. So everyone is writing, I have skills and so on, I can be a leader. So how is it the committee was judging or seeing my CV, how can they judge these points? How can they know if this is true or not? So if I can understand how the committee is thinking, then I can improve the way I'm writing. which tool I mentioned here that will be recommended for that certification or so?
I don't, not necessarily. I mean, if you've taken a specific course that Lynn adds value to what you've done, I would put that in there, but I don't think you need that certificate attached to that resume. Again, it just adds to that stack of papers that we need to look through. So we're assuming that what you write in your application package is true. And so the documentation that might go along with that, I don't think is really necessary.
And I think a lot of the times those things will either be confirmed or denied in your interview as well as in the when your reference letters are looked at. So when the committee gets letters of reference or asks phone calls with who you provided as references, they're going to be able to get a little bit more information on that and confirm that, yes, you can do these various things and so on. So, other questions? Yes?
When it comes to a teaching philosophy statement, what like types of main areas do are typically looked for?
It's been a while since I've looked at mine. Typically, you're gonna talk about a little bit about the learning process. You might talk about, for example, you might talk about Bloom's taxonomy or something in your teaching philosophy that says, this is how students learn, and in my course, I want to make sure that they achieve the ultimate levels of learning by learning how to synthesize and analyze concepts and so on. So you might say, well, I teach with this strategy in mind. You might say something effective, a particular philosophy you have on, for example, is your philosophy, you want, students to succeed no matter what. So you might allow them to retake exams or turn in homework assignments that they didn't do well so they can relearn those concepts that they missed or something. So whatever your typical philosophy is, do you like to have students work together in groups? Do you not like to have them work in groups? Do you want to, and do you do a multiple choice test? Do you do essay tests? So you're going to write about how you teach and how that relates to student learning. The teaching philosophy should be all about, it should be student-centered. It shouldn't be, this is what I do to make them learn the concepts. It should be all about students learn best when this occurs, and so therefore I try to teach in that manner. And like I said, there's going to be different philosophies. There's all kinds of different strategies you can use in the classroom. So I would focus your teaching philosophy on what you think, a little bit about how students learn, how that impacts your teaching, and then just some. I think like one of the panelists recommended earlier, what is it about when you're in a classroom? What is it about the classes that you like the most? And you're going to incorporate some of that stuff into your teaching philosophy because you know that you like those classes best when the instructor does X, Y, and Z, and so you're going to incorporate a little bit of that in. If you've never taught a class before, you're going to write it like that. Say, this is what I've observed in the classes that I've been in, and this is how I would teach a class. If you've been a TA or something like that, you're going to reference your own personal experiences in teaching or TAing those classes and how you use those different exercises and so on to help with the teaching process. Yeah, follow-up question.
I mean, so you wouldn't, put references or nothing bad in there, like Bloom's tech, all that kind of stuff?
No, you don't need to cite papers or anything like that, so.
Thank you.
Yes?
I'm filling out a job application right now, and it asks for an evaluation of your teaching. Would you scan, student evaluations?
No, that's against FERPA.
Okay.
You cannot do that.
But how would you consider
what that? What you can do is you can have somebody type the, technically you're not supposed to be written student evaluations. You should have somebody type the student evaluations and give them back to you. You can provide a little table of assessment of the scores you got and put them relative to the college if they're particularly good. Mm-hmm. So you can synthesize that pretty easily. And yes, that is something that's often asked for. And additionally, do not, and it's nice to hear Joe say that they always require a teaching seminar, do not dismiss that. One of our last job searches, the candidate we hired, because three people flamed out spectacularly in their teaching seminar. One person had to be cut off at 65 minutes, which showed they had no concept of time management in the classroom. So really think about that. And if you haven't lectured before, get somebody who you think teaches well to listen to you go all the way through it. Because it is a teaching seminar. Often we ask for them, we actually ask the person to teach as if they were teaching an introductory class. We don't want a seminar about your thoughts and philosophies about teaching. We want you to teach an introductory class. And we actually sit out there and we're the mock classroom. So we ask questions at that level. So depending on it's pretty
sometimes
at that level. But do if you're interviewing for and have been asked to do that, do get guidance. You have the right to ask the chair of the search committee, is this what I'm preparing? Is this what you're expecting? And ask how long. And don't go over, because then you'll be the candidate that went too long.
It's better, yeah. I'd recommend going short.
Short.
They like that, the other faculty.
Yeah, short answers.
So we do a similar type of teaching seminar. We actually will give you, on the last one we gave a topic area. We said here, this is the kind of course you're going to be teaching. This is the general topic area. And we had a set of students that came in that we made sure would be part of each interview so that we could have a consistent audience in addition to the faculty and staff. And we did ask questions at that level. In order to assess, not only how do you teach, but how do you respond to questions? Are you able to think on your feet relative to the topic that you are giving?
Yes.
If you are asked to give a teaching philosophy seminar, how would you go about that and make it interesting enough for 20 or 25 minutes?
Typically, I can reference from my experience, if I'm asked to give, like in my case, an extension seminar, then I give the first 35, 40 minutes or so on whatever extension topic they've given me, and then I conclude with 5 or 10 minutes on a little bit about my extension philosophy and how that would play a role in how what I would do with this position should I be hired. And so you can do the same thing with the teaching philosophy. The teaching philosophy, you could do these in reverse, too. You could start off and say, this is my philosophy or whatever, and then say, okay, let's go into this mock teaching environment. Either way, but that's what I would say, is you're probably, in most cases, going to be asked to give more of a teaching extension seminar, and then you could conclude that with a few short slides on your philosophy and how that relates to the classroom or the extension duties, something along those lines. And you can do the same thing with your research seminar. You should always finish your research seminar off with, this is how my research would play a role in this department. This is the collaborations I foresee doing, that kind of thing. Because that's the most number of people you have to evaluate you at any one time is going to be during your seminars, and they're going to be really interested in how are you going to be a potential member of their group. And so they're looking for you to come up with, and to provide them with that kind of information during your seminar. And so that's what I would make sure that you have a little bit of that at the end.
Follow-up question on the student evaluations. At our university, after you teach, you get your student evaluations all abbreviated. You get the little boxes where it breaks it down by department, by university. You also get the statements that they write, and then if they sign them, it says signed, and it has their name on it. And I feel like, and for professors, when they're signed, it's more serious than professional equipment. But as a TA, I don't know what that means, like to have it signed, like the student stands behind their statement. So I don't know if I was applying for a position, if I would include just the fact that it had been signed. Or
you could maybe say, at our university they're allowed to sign the documents, and these have been signed. We typically mean that to be that this statement has a lot of weight behind it. And you can say that.
Okay, I don't want to include it.
No, you don't. Yeah, it's a murky world as you get into that sort of stuff, as to what goes beyond privacy. And so I always err on the side of extreme.
But I think general in the application documents, they're just looking for some kind of level of, is this person an awful teacher or an average teacher or a really good teacher? And so most of the time they're just going to be looking at numbers. But if you want to, especially if it's a teaching position, you want to supplement that with some student comments, and I think that's appropriate. Other questions? Yes?
If an
I think you have to know specifically how they, because typically, well, at least in an academic position, they'll often talk about references, but they'll be specific about we want them now or we don't want them now, because they don't want to have all these reference letters with these packets when they're just going to end up throwing a bunch of them out. So it's not atypical that they won't ask for references until you've been asked to interview. Or they might just ask you for a list of references, and then they might solicit reference letters after you've been invited to an interview. But as far as you guys ask for references typically on your positions? Or?
No, we do not specifically ask for references, but what we will do is if someone mentions someone in a cover letter, like I was talking about with one of our own employees, or we've hired from a certain department and the other employees, you know, we have relationships with other people. So, you know, if you work under a certain faculty person, we might contact them. Or we do our own work. Yeah. It's in there.
I think if you're going to ask someone to write, to be on your list of references, you want to go, you clearly need to go and ask those people. And I think the best question to ask them is, can you provide a good reference for me? You want to, you know, we're going to assume that the references you choose are going to, and you're going to pick those that you think are going to give you an excellent reference. But it's always a good way to sort of phrase that question to them.
All right, we have time for one more question and another question from the audience. Yes?
Sometimes you fill out an online application for something, and there might be these questions on it. And sometimes you don't have a good answer, because it's a multiple choice question, and sometimes your situation doesn't quite fit. But they might say, you know, do you have experience with this? And they're like, well, not exactly, or something similar. What do you do in those situations?
So are there any dialogue boxes with that, or is it
often not?
I guess, and again, I don't know how these are typically done, but if there's an opportunity to put a cover letter in or something like that after you go through those questions, maybe that's the part, that's where you can put some of that information in. It's a challenge, though, when you have a generic document that's going to rise to quite a few different positions.
I think you choose the answer closest to how you might answer that. C. A, B, C. Big C.
I will say that truth rules. If you do something, if you have something on your document that is not exactly truthful, it will come out at some point in time, and you're automatically eliminated. So again, you want to err on the side of caution. You know, publications, Beth talked about that. You know, make sure if you put them under peer review that they actually are. And, you know, some of those are a little gray area, some gray areas, particularly in the teaching component, as to how you go through that peer review process. And that was a new thing for me as a department head, is how education articles are go through this sort of a convoluted peer review process. So you just need to be aware of some things.
Let me join me in thanking the rest of our panelists for their time today. Appreciate that. I've got just a couple comments. I'll get us out of here on time. One thing that was really helpful for me is this job, this book here called The Academic Job Search Handbook. And this is the fourth edition. This is my copy. You can come up and take a look at this if you want. But this was helpful for me. It's got examples of cover letters, examples of resumes from all different disciplines. It's not going to tell you exactly how to do yours, but if you're starting from scratch, you have no idea where to start, then this might give you some guidance on there. There's a little bit in here on interviewing, but that's a whole separate related topic. We do have some other sessions from our early career member programs this week, and one of those is on interviewing. On Wednesday, there's a session that starts at noon on interviewing and negotiating skills. And so I realize the topic that we talked about is very closely tied to interviewing, and so if you have more questions about interviewing, especially negotiating, then you want to visit that session on Wednesday. I got a couple slides to show you. We do have a website that the Early Career Member Committee puts together, and that's located on all the Tri-Society websites. It says Crop Science Society up there, but it's located on all those websites, and it has information that's relevant to you and hopefully helpful for you as you progress through your career. The way to find that website is just go to any of the three society pages. I've shown you Crop Science here, and on the bottom right-hand corner, you'll see a link there to the Early Career Member website. So that's how you can navigate to that particular website. And then the last workshop I want to point you to is we do have a grant writing workshop this Wednesday from 10:30 to noon. And the thing that's a little bit unique about this workshop, and I'll leave this slide up here so you can take some notes, is it's these four panelists from all different governmental groups are going to be around all week. And so if you have a conflict with this time but you'd still like to meet with them, then you can send them an email or set up a time to meet with them while you're here. But if you're a little bit interested in learning about the grant writing process, which many of you are at this stage in your career, then these panelists are going to be here. So, and the last note I have is for those of you that were able to fill out the surveys, we really appreciate your feedback on what kind of sessions you'd like to hear at next year's meeting. And so there's opportunity for you to evaluate this session as well as to check what kind of topics you'd like to hear from next year. And Dennis in the back of the room is going to collect those as you exit. So thank you all for coming today. I appreciate it.